This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. When Dr. James Lowen wrote the book Lies My Teacher Told Me in the 1990s, it served as a lesson that just because something is written in a textbook doesn't mean it's an accurate depiction of what happened, and that women and people of color may have a very different version of historic events. Lowen spoke to current and future educators during a recent trip to La Crosse. He also gave a public presentation about how the city of La Crosse should be considered a sundown town and must come to grips with the form of segregation that has traditionally excluded people of color. During his visit, Lowen stopped by the WPR studio in La Crosse to talk about the importance of correcting American history textbooks.
I suppose my overall message is the way we learned U.S. history in high school was terrible. We learned all kinds of things that didn't happen. We didn't learn all kinds of important things that did happen. And as a result, we're kind of stupid. And we're stupid in how we think about the United States, how we think about the present. So the reason that I am so interested in the past, I'm not a historian by trade, I'm a sociologist, but I have found that what we mislearn about the past has intense relevance to how we think about the present and what we get wrong about the now.
Can you give an example of how misinformation about the past has come back to influence us?
Sure. If you ask Americans, why did we have a civil war? Of course, they say, well, we had a civil war because the South seceded, and that's correct. So then if you ask, well, why did the South secede? You always get four answers. You get the answers that South seceded for slavery, seceded for states' rights, seceded because of the election of Lincoln, and seceded over tariffs and taxes, issues about that. And then if you ask them to vote, typically, and I've done this in Wisconsin, I've done it in Florida, and every point in between, Southern California, North Dakota, 65% of most audiences, including 65% of K-12 teachers who are teaching American history, say the South seceded for states' rights. Now, that's completely wrong, just totally wrong. In fact, the South seceded against states' rights. They were upset about states' rights. They were mad about various northern states, including Wisconsin, and things they had done. And they're happy as a clam with the federal government under Buchanan and were not seceding because of anything the federal government had done. Now, does that make a difference today? Well, you betcha, because one of the reasons we have all these Confederate monuments everywhere, and we have a college named Calhoun College at Yale, named for John C. Calhoun, famous secessionist theorizer, is because the Confederacy enjoys such a wonderful reputation. I mean, anybody who's ever had any trouble with the IRS can kind of sympathize with states' rights. So that's an example, then, of a lie, actually. It's so 180 degrees wrong, we have to call it that, that comes from about 1890 that is messing with our minds in 2016.
And so, you know, your book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, it reviewed a number of different history textbooks. And, you know, these are all from different, you know, publishers. And how did these, you know, inaccuracies or misinformation about our past...
How'd they get in there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the first thing you have to realize, and I actually proved this when I was writing the second edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me, the books are not written by their authors. Now, you might say, Lowen, wait a minute. Aren't authors the one who writes the book? No. They rent those names, famous historians. But we don't know who writes the books. And I prove this partly because Prentice Hall, in their infinite wisdom, trying to save a dime, instead of hiring one hack to write the revised edition of a book allegedly by Burston and Kelly. Now, Daniel Burston is a librarian of Congress, very famous historian, won the Pulitzer Prize twice. Brooks Mather Kelly, chief archivist at Yale. They didn't write their book. They hired a hack to write the book. But instead of hiring a different hack to write this other book called Pathways to the Present, which is allegedly by four professors, most of them at Miami University of Ohio, they used the same hack twice. And so the last chapter of the book, where for the new edition, reads the same for page after page, or maybe one of the paragraphs has the word very in it. It went through different copy editing maybe, but they hired the same guy twice. So I managed to actually discover this. And it's interesting that I discovered it. What this shows is that in all these school districts that adopt books, in all these states that adopt books statewide, like famously Texas, nobody actually reads the books, because if they had, they would have discovered just what I had, that two of the books were identical for most of a whole chapter. But I discovered it. Well, I got a front page article in the New York Times out of it, and the authors wound up with egg on their face, but nothing else happened to them. You know, nobody cares what happens to a textbook. The American Historical Association doesn't even review them.
And so you mentioned this earlier of, you know, this idea that we need to understand our history to, you know, be able to move forward successfully in the future. You know, and kind of what are the dangers of not knowing our history?
Well, the first problem is we don't think causally. In the textbooks, the way they present history is just one damn thing after another. It's not clear how A causes B, B causes C. If we just think about race relations, how did La Crosse become so white? Most Wisconsin towns had larger black populations in 1890 than they did by 1940. And this is completely unnatural. I mean, the black population of the United States starts out mostly, of course, in the southern states, enslaved. And then as soon as slavery breaks down around 1863 to 1865, black folks start going everywhere. And they wind up in every county in Montana, for instance, except one. They wind up in every county in Indiana, except one. They wind up across the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And then, after 1890, they unwind up. That is, they retreat from all of these places, and something bad happens. Well, the textbooks can never help us deal with anything that's going retrograde, that's getting worse, because the basic storyline is, we started out great, and we've been getting better ever since. And if anything goes in the opposite direction, and things do sometimes, then they can't think about why. They won't even tell us that it went in the opposite direction. So that's an example, again, of how we just don't think right about the present because of the way we've been taught about the past.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Dr. James Lowen, an award-winning historian and sociologist who studied the misinformation that's often taught in American history and why knowing our past is so important. And so you mentioned earlier that, you know, you're a sociologist by trade, but how did you get interested in looking at, American history?
First of all, I have to say the world, of course, doesn't come divided up into sociology and history and poli-sci and so on. My doctoral dissertation, for instance, was called The Mississippi Chinese Between Black and White, and I studied this unusual third race in a system built for two from about 1868 till about 1968 when I was writing the book. So is that history? Well, yes. Is that sociology? Well, yes. You know, it's even poli-sci in some ways. That's the first point. But the second point I would say is I got so interested in history, which is, of course, what we tell ourselves about the past, from my first full-time teaching job. And that was at Tougaloo College. That's a black college in Mississippi, right next to Jackson, Mississippi. And I taught there for 7 years. And my first year there, I was teaching the courses I expected to be teaching in sociology, but I was also asked to teach one section of a course called the Freshman Social Science Seminar, which introduced students to sociology, of course, and poli-sci, econ, psych, and so on. It was invented by the history department, and it was done in the context of African-American history. It made sense, 99% of our students being African-American. Well, so second semester begins right after Christmas, but it also begins right after the Civil War in that context. So I didn't want to do all the talking that first day of class, so I asked my students, okay, what happened during Reconstruction? That's, of course, the period right after the Civil War. And what images do you have? And my students said, 16 out of 17 of them said, well, that was the period right after the Civil War when blacks took over the government of the southern states, but they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again. Now, there are at least three, probably four, direct lies in that sentence. Blacks never took over the government of the southern states. The southern states governments during Reconstruction did not screw up. They did all kinds of various interesting things. They passed the best state constitutions that the southern states have ever had. They started the public school system for both races. Mississippi in particular had better government during Reconstruction than at any later point in the 19th century. And so, therefore, whites didn't take control at the end of Reconstruction. A certain group of whites, white racist Democrats using KKK tactics, indeed it was, of course, the original Ku Klux Klan, they took over. So I'm saying to myself, my God, what must it do to you to believe that the one time your group was center stage in American history, they screwed up? For that matter, what does it do to white folks? You know, ninth grade white folks who learn the one time those black folks took over is terrible. So it makes everybody more anti-black, if you will. So I went to nearby schools to see this happening. How could this happen? Tougaloo is a very good college. My students were good students. They were learning. I watched as a black teacher taught an all-black class, this white supremacist, we call it BS in sociology. That means bad sociology. Because he was just teaching what was in the book. So that taught me that history can be a weapon, that it can be used against you, and that it had been used against my students. And when I then went from I claim I went from the blackest college in America to the whitest college in America because I wound up at the University of Vermont. And I found that my students, again, in white Vermont, had learned the damnedest things that didn't happen in the past and didn't know the most important things that did happen. And so I realized Mississippi exemplified this problem in a more exaggerated form, as Mississippi exemplified lots of things in the 1970s and 80s in a more exaggerated form. But this was a national problem. So that's why I've been interested in history ever since.
You know, over the past year, maybe two, we have seen, you know, increasing tensions between the African American community and, you know, police in our country, and just, you know, racial inequality has really come to the forefront of things. You know, do you think that our history or our lack of understanding about our history is really, you know, kind of feeding the racial inequality and the tensions that we're seeing today?
Sure, I think it's part of it. I will say this. I'm an optimist. I'm encouraged by the tension. I think we have several movements going on today that are positive, and I'm going to be talking about that today. One of them is the anti-Confederate movement. I mean, literally, until a guy named Dylan Storm Roof murdered 9 African-American parishioners at a church in Charleston, I guess by now a year and a half ago. Until then, the Confederacy and lies about the Confederacy still held forth and held a privileged position in American society, North as well as South. And you get these astounding things like Calhoun College at Yale University. Calhoun College is a dormitory. They use the term college where any normal school would use the term dormitory. But they named this college, this dormitory, for John C. Calhoun in about 1935. Now, that's an astounding thing to do if you learn what John C. Calhoun stood for and what he did. He was the architect of secession. He provided the intellectual framework for secession on behalf of white supremacy. He also provided the framework for the intellectual framework for slavery. Of course, slavery had been going on. And we name a building for him, an important building, at Yale University in 1935. Why in the world would we do that? Why do we have Jefferson Davis Highway that starts at the border of Washington, D.C., goes down through Virginia all the way to Mississippi, then it goes clear over to San Diego, comes up through Seattle, and ends at the Canadian border? It's the longest named highway in the United States. Named why? I mean, what are we honoring when we honor Jefferson Davis? We are not honoring his service as Secretary of War, I think it was, under Buchanan. We're not honoring that he was a really good senator. No, we are honoring him because, of course, he led secession, treason, on behalf of slavery, okay? In other words, because he was the leader of the Confederacy. So the fact that we now have an anti-Confederate movement, that we have a Black Lives Matter movement that is questioning police behavior, we've had bad police behavior in places by people, not by all police, of course, since the slavery patrol days in 1619 or so and until now. But now, with cell phones and with the intellectual movement going on, we're questioning it. So more power to these movements.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Dr. James Loewen, an award-winning author who studied the misinformation that's often taught in American history and why knowing our past is so important. And so, you know, you've talked about how, you know, we need to rethink the way that we often teach American history. But do you think broader curriculum reform is needed in the education system?
Well, I think that history stands out as the worst taught subject. And there's some, I'm a sociologist. We try to use evidence for this rather than just, I think. So let me give you a couple of pieces of evidence. Sometimes I hold up my bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me, and say, I could have subtitled this book, Revenge Against Coach DeMolin. Because Coach DeMolin, the basketball coach, was my history teacher in Decatur, Illinois, right in the middle of Illinois. Well, there's only one field where that kind of thing goes on. Coach DeMolin would never be assigned to teach math. Everybody knows he doesn't know any math. There aren't enough PE classes for all these coaches. This is a Midwestern phenomenon, incidentally, and a Southern phenomenon, and in particular a Texas phenomenon, that we have people teaching out of field in history. In fact, 15% of the people teaching history in high schools across America never had one course in it. Now, there's no other field that can make that statement. You know, if you're an English teacher, well, in fact, you can't even graduate from college, I don't think, without having a required course in English. So we know you've had at least one course in English. If you're teaching physics, you probably majored in physics. You certainly had at least one course in physics. So I think history stands out as the worst taught course. And I think there's a second reason for that, too. And I draw that from the book titles. We have history textbooks called things like Rise of the American Nation. You can't see this on the radio, but I'm putting up my right hand because you almost have to be putting my hand over my heart. That after we lost the war in Vietnam, that book got changed to Triumph of the American Nation. The Great Republic, The Great Experiment, Land of the Free, etc. Well, we don't call books like that in geometry or American literature. The book is called Reader in American Literature. In chemistry, we don't call the book Triumph of the Molecules, you know. So there's, in other words, there's some nationalism going on. We have to kind of salute the flag while we're taking notes on our history textbook. I think history is the worst, therefore.
Is this a problem in other countries?
Yes.
Do you know?
Yes. I only read English to my soul, but I have I try to keep up with what's going on in other countries. And by the way, it's a big issue these days and has been for at least 15 years between China, Korea, and Japan. Each of them writing their own nationalist history, especially Japan, is the issue. Because Japan, by the time you get done reading one of Japan's approved textbooks, admittedly it's not the best one and it's used by only a very few schools, but still, China and Korea are both outraged that Japan would even approve this textbook. It basically mystifies why World War II ever happened. It mystifies that the Japanese took most of China and waged war against the whole country, you know. By the time you end up reading it, you are stupider about the past, just like some American history textbooks. So this is not unique to the United States at all. There are some places doing better, and just two to think about. Russia is one, and South Africa is another one. After the one person, one vote revolution, shall we say, in South Africa, these four women K-12 teachers, I think that's what they all were, wrote a book about this problem. It's called A New History for a New South Africa. And they started right off saying, you know, up until the end of white supremacy and the rule of South Africa, we emphasized the following six myths in South African history. And I'm reading these myths and say, yeah, you know, we teach about four of those ourselves. But now that's totally inappropriate. We gotta rethink this from the ground up. It's a great book. I mean, you know, we kind of need to rethink ours from the ground up, too.
People often say that history is written by the winners, whether that's, you know, the winners of a war or whatnot. Do you think that's true? And do you think that that, I don't know, that has a part in this?
I think it is true. And I think, bizarrely enough, it shows that the white Confederate South won the Civil War in 1890. Now, of course, I know it ended in 1865. I know it ended in surrender at Appomattox and then surrender in Bentonville, North Carolina, and so on. But the white, we need to call them neo-Confederates because by 1890, it's a new generation. They won it in about 1890. And they won it in various ways. I'm going to talk about that in my talk today. They won it on the ground. They won it with Confederate monuments everywhere. Confederate monuments go up between 1890 and 1940. Very few go up before 1890 because they didn't win it until 1890. You put up monuments after you win. You know, you might think about, listeners might think about the Vietnam Memorial in D.C. We lost that war, of course, and that memorial is a gash in the earth. It didn't go up. It went down, as it were. So as long as we understand that between 1890 and in some ways yesterday, the Confederates won the war, then we can say, yes, the winners write the history.
And so how do you think that, you know, the recording of events, the recording of you know, today's, what will become, you know, tomorrow's history, how do you think that is changing? And, you know, is it getting better?
Well, I'm hoping it is. And maybe I'm just a blind optimist, but we do have something different nowadays. It's called the web. And as a result, you can record, you know, on your Facebook page. You have one, right? on your in your Instagrams or wherever emails go when they die. I guess they go to WikiLeaks or they go to the National Security Agency. So maybe they're keeping them all. Maybe they've got a little file on Hope or on me, Jim Lowen. I certainly hope so. I wouldn't want to be left out. Anyway, I'm being a little silly about it, but we all have the capability of blogging. We all have the capability of making a website and keeping it up for a while. Now, this is an interesting problem because what's going to happen to the, you know, if you write a book, I read a book the other day that was written, published in about 1872, and my copy was 1872. It's not clear that we're going to be able to blog something in 2016, and let's see, 1872, that's about 145 years later. And 145 years later, we'll be able to find our blog. You know, today's history is maybe very impermanent, so that could be a problem. But the interesting advantage of it is that it's not as gate-kept. You don't just have six high school history publishers and you have to rely on them. There's all kinds of other sources out there. So I'm an optimist about that side of it. Now, of course, that means there's all kinds of people publishing all kinds of things. I still am an optimist because I think that causes students to have to become critical readers, critical thinkers. You just can't reproduce what a KKK site says about Martin Luther King and what some other more responsible site says about Martin Luther King without noticing there's a little tension between the two sites. And you do, so the bland high school history textbooks all read alike. We've already discussed why. But the websites don't all read alike. So I think that's good too, in that it almost forces us to be critical thinkers.
Dr. James Lowen is the author of the book Lies My Teacher Told Me, which focused on inaccuracies in history textbooks. He was in La Crosse recently talking about racism and segregation at presentations at UW-La Crosse and in the community. Coming up, we'll talk with Nobel Prize-winning scientist Mario Capecchi. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. Thank you. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Mario Capecchi has quite a story. As a young child in Italy during World War II, he was separated from his family, living in orphanages and on the street. When he was found by his mother at age 9, they moved to America and lived with relatives who are Quakers. His love of science led to a career as a molecular geneticist and eventually to the 2007 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for his work in gene targeting of mice, which he believes will eventually help with the treatment of human disease.
The technology allows you to change any gene in any conceivable manner. And why would you, and our patients are mice. So we do everything in mice. And it allows you, imagine that you have an enormous instruction volume, book, and it has instructions for doing everything from starting with an egg and a sperm, and then you have conception, and then you have development of an embryo, and then finally the fetus, and then finally it's born, and it progresses all the way to an adult. All along during that pathway, you're changing and making new pathways. For example, your brain is developing and making all sorts of pathways to be able to see, to hear, to taste, to smell. And all of this is in a written in a language that you don't understand. It's a foreign language. And the way that we interrogate that language is to change it. It's about 1,000 volumes of information, each volume being about 1,000 pages long. And so we can go to a particular volume and change the text and then ask what are the consequences to either the formation of the mouse or its ability to function as an adult and anything in between. And then when you see a defect, because that's the only change that that mouse has, then we can attribute that to that particular gene and therefore infer what the function of that gene is by seeing what abnormality happens. For example, if little finger disappears, we're knowing the program to make little finger. But what we can additionally do is to model any disease. And it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's cancer, whether it's schizophrenia, whether it's diabetes. You can model that in a mouse and see which genes are participating in that disease, study it in detail that is not possible in humans, and then turn around and use it as a platform for developing therapies. So, and that's true no matter what the disease is. And there are thousands of diseases that have a genetic basis.
And so this work, you won a Nobel Prize in 2007 for mm-hmm. gene targeting. And how has that changed your life?
Well, it's changed my life, and it's changed a lot of other people's lives in terms of, now thousands of laboratories can do it, and each can pursue it for their particular interest. And what we've done is simply choose, now we could work on anything we wanted. What are we interested in doing? And the thing that right now, for example, we're working on two problems. One is cancers that other people aren't interested in. And the other people aren't interested in not because they're not important, but because they're not as common. The most common human cancers are called carcinomas, which are all a result from surfaces, skin, for example. When we're working what are called sarcomas, which are soft tissue cancers, they're still solid tumors, but they occur in things like muscle. And the reason we're interested in is that they affect a very important population, and that's children and young adults. So if I get cancer, I've had my chance. But if a child has cancer and dies of it, then that's they've never even had a chance to show what they want to do. So that's why we work on them. And they're extremely brutal in the sense that, for example, the cancer I'm going to be talking about, 80% of those children will die within 5 years after first presentation. And that prognosis hasn't changed over the last 3 decades. Simply because people aren't working on it and seeing. And unfortunately, every cancer is different. I mean, there are hundreds of different types of cancers. Each is different, and each is going to have its own solution. And so by studying this, we're going to be helping kids. If you're a pediatric oncologist, that's all you see. But on terms of total number of cancers, they're a minority.
And the other presentation you're giving here at UWL is entitled Making of a Scientist, an Unlikely Journey. And you have had a unique journey through life. You know, what's the big message that you hope people take away from your story?
I think the one message I want to get across is, first of all, that, you know, give everybody an equal chance. I mean, and this is particularly with respect to education, of particularly for young people, because, you know, everything I do is essentially was the reason it worked is because I got a good education and got an opportunity to make it work. Without that education, without that opportunity, it would have never worked. So I think it's, and we're not wise enough to say, you know, this person's going to be brilliant and this person is not going to be very productive. And so the only equitable way to do it is to give everybody a chance and then see what they do with it. And then it's there, at least they have a chance. So I think that's the big take-home lesson. And then the other is simply to have some confidence in yourself to push yourself as far as you can go to achieve what, you know, what you are capable of.
So your start in education was in Pennsylvania. You moved here after World War II with your mother to live with your aunt and uncle. And I understand your aunt and uncle were Quakers.
That's true, yep.
And you also attended a Quaker high school.
Yep.
How do you think, you know, living in a Quaker community shaped your perspective of the world?
Enormously, because it's, you know, they don't believe in any frills, and they're, even their clothing. I mean, if they had, you know, some colors are not even represented, for example, red or yellow. Or, you know, but what they do believe in is, A, that there's something good in every person, and B, is that it's, you know, you're here essentially to be of service. So it's, you're not here simply to have a good time, but that you do make the world a better place. And so actually in, at that time, it was clear that all problems were political. And so actually I started college as a political scientist. And I lasted one quarter because I couldn't find science in political science and switched to physics. So I think it's, you know, I think there is irony sometimes in what happens, but I think what is important is to always continue doing things that make you excited and that you can be passionate about, because we only get one chance. And so, you know, all of us walk through this life, and we should do the best we can with it and do something that's also useful to other people.
Did that mentality influence, you know, your motivation in choosing different areas of study and research in science?
No, it does. I mean, I think it, because, you know, service, I think, you know, what you know, one of the things that everybody has to face and is good health. I mean, if you have good health, you can be productive. If you're in poor health, you can't be productive. And so one of the things that you can do to improve the world is make it so people have a longer period of productivity. They're certainly now living longer, but what's more important is, can you be productive and happy during that period of time, and also pursue and be given a chance? I mean, I think some people are exasperated simply because they feel they never get a chance. And I think we should provide the opportunity. I mean, when I came here, I literally expected to the United States, I literally expected the roads to be paved with gold. And what I found was something that's actually much more valuable, and that's opportunity.
And so you did your graduate studies at Harvard under Dr. James Watson, and you've said that he had a profound influence on your career. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Yeah. He was, first of all, he was a very good mentor, was very supportive, and he also had a good feeling for biology. He, I didn't learn how to do science from him, but what I learned to do is to evaluate a status of a particular area and be able to look at it and see what do they know and what don't they know, and what should be pursued in order to extend that particular field. So it gives you sort of an overview as opposed to thinking about the more the nuts and bolts of what has to be done. And I think both are important to science. I mean, biology is complicated enough that it's not going to ever be theoretical. It's always going to be experimental, and so you're going to have to prove whatever you are hypothesizing and see where it goes. But what's nice about it is that there are an enormous number of surprises. Nature has put things together in very complicated ways, and not necessarily what we would consider logical ways. Rather, they find a solution and then utilize that solution. And it's our job to figure out how it works. And then once you understand how it works, then you can start utilizing it to make better, more productive people in the sense of better health. I mean, and a big frontier now, for example, is neuropsychiatric disorders. And before we can actually work on that, we have to understand how the brain works. So we have a lot ahead of us because we know very little bit about how the brain works. And then once we understand that, then drugs will be much more effective in the sense that they'll be going after the disease as opposed to simply controlling the person.
And from your descriptions of your time at Harvard under Dr. Watson, it seems like it was a very collaborative atmosphere.
He's a mixture. I mean, he's also very competitive. And he would also set up false competitions where actually he would tell you if somebody else is doing exactly what you're doing, you better work hard. But in reality, he actually was a friend of the person that was competing with you. So I think he was a complicated individual, and I think he fostered, you know, being rigorous, being bold, and working hard. But it involved also a lot of competition. I think I'm a little bit not quite a strong believer in competition, and that I think that often, well, always, two minds are better than one. And synergy often gets you along a lot faster than competition.
And I know that synergy was one of the reasons that you later decided to move to Utah to continue your studies, or your research, rather. Tell me a little bit about the atmosphere there.
Well, the exciting part was that it was a new department, and we could hire whoever is going to be there next. And so you could choose people that would like working together, to enjoy doing science together, and talking about science, as opposed simply to people that are good and would be good anywhere, but not necessarily wanting to interact. And so, you know, in a sense, Utah was the only game in town. And so under those circumstances, the way to reach critical mass is to work together. So either you all prosper or you all sink. And whereas in other situations, you might find that it's not that important to be synergized because there are many possibilities of who you interact with. So I think we purposely set out to make a department that would be a comfortable place for lots of people, and also that they were people that like to be scientists and work together.
And why did you want to achieve that atmosphere?
We're in science just to have fun. I mean, you have puzzles and you're solving puzzles, and you're always thinking about new problems and what their solutions are. And it should be fun. I mean, I could make a lot more money doing something else, but then I wouldn't have as much fun. You know, it's just sort of being a child through the rest of your life, so you're always playing.
And do you think that, students who are getting into the sciences, do you think they recognize that fun atmosphere?
Right. No, I think they should. Because, I go back to do the thing that you most enjoy doing. Because if you enjoy it, you'll do a good job at it. If you don't enjoy it, it'll be hard work. And so, you know, my own wife claims that I never work. I'm always playing, that I should get serious and do something serious. But I think in terms of playing, we're also producing things that are useful to other people. So I think if you can combine those two, that is, it has utility, but at the same time has a component of fun to it, then I think you go a long ways.
In your opinion, what has been your greatest achievement so far?
Well, gene targeting, developing that technology is what our lab is noted for, and that's our contribution. But, you know, if you ask me, you know, what am I interested in, what I will describe is what I'm working on today. Because science is, you know, is always changing. Yesterday actually never counts in science. It's always today and tomorrow. So you're always looking to the future and the things that you don't know as opposed to the things you do know. And I think you can't anticipate where that'll take you. I think you also, you have to be open, and sometimes you have to be lucky.
And, you know, what do you think makes a good scientist? I know you've mentioned different characteristics so far, but...
Yeah, I think, you know, one is simply curiosity. You know, when you're a child, every day you ask, the child asks why. Why this, why that? And, you know, you hear that over and over and over again. And in science, it's important to maintain that curiosity and then strive from it and get a kick out of it. And try to understand not how you would think about biology, but how nature has thought about biology and discover her secrets as opposed to, you know, it often doesn't have a logic. And that, and you know, and I think sometimes if you're coming from physics, for example, that's sort of frustrating. But I think what's more interesting is simply the complexity of the solution that nature found. And sometimes it's very profound and extremely, you know, has, it's beautiful. I mean, it has a lot of aesthetic value.
And so what is the next thing that you hope to achieve?
Well, I have about projects that will take me about 30 years. So it's so I'm quite optimistic at how long I'm going to be productive and how long I'm going to live. My wife also says I'm going to die in the lab. But we have enormous plans, and some of the projects are, you know, right now seem impossible. But, you know, I was raised on a particular aphorism. And that is that the difficult we do right away, the impossible takes a little longer.
And what is the most important way that that science has changed in you know, the last 10, 20 years?
Yeah. No, that's the nice thing about science is that the reason it's not boring is that it's always changing. And what comes along is that new technology which allows you then to approach the problem in a way that you never previously conceived of. I mean, an example is what's called deep sequencing. We can now very quickly sequence very complicated genomes and all of a sudden have that information. The first genome, the human genome, took about 20 years to develop and to get the results. Now the same genome will take about less than a few days. So it's been an enormous change in speed and efficiency and cost of being able to do experiments, and then you can utilize that information in new ways that weren't conceivable even just a few years ago. And so that's what's exciting. What you often do is simply see what new technology is coming along and how can I utilize that to now address questions that were previously not possible. So it's, you're always looking for change. It's not very comfortable. I mean, I think, you know, often human beings are comfortable just sitting in front of the TV with a beer and some potato chips and just, you know, absorbing it. In science, you're always on a discomfort level in the sense that you never know what the answer is. You're always striving, and then sometimes you're lucky and you find something that's really significant.
Was there anything I didn't ask you about that you think would be important to know?
Well, I think, again, you know, have confidence. You know, the one thing that I don't know where it comes from, and that is confidence, and it's very important because it carries you through hard times to begin with, so that, you know, science isn't always smooth. Sometimes things don't work, and you keep battling away and trying to figure out why it's not working. And so you have to go through those periods and then know that you're going to come through them, and that takes a certain amount of confidence. So I think from somewhere you have to be confident in yourself and also be confident in the choices that you make. But if you're going to make choices that open up possibilities as opposed to constrict possibilities, because then you can always go forward.
Mario Capecchi is the 2007 Nobel Prize winner in Physiology or Medicine for his work in gene targeting, which could lead to new treatments of human disease. He spoke last fall as the UW-La Crosse Distinguished Speaker in Life Sciences.
And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.